Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. We're on vacation, but that doesn't mean we don't have an amazing show for you today. Director Matt Tiernauer stops by to talk some of the hidden political figures who've shaped our politics. But first, we have Veep executive producer, the one, the only, Dave Mandel. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Dave Mandel.
Thank you. Always happy to come back.
I wanted to have you back because I just love you and think you're so funny, but also, more importantly, because I feel like you are both a historian with the White House Plumbers and a futurist with Veep.
I didn't know I was a futurist when I was a futurist. You know, I think I may have said to you one time privately, you know, this was a bunch of people sitting in an office in Hollywood thinking up the stupidest thing a president could do, like the worst thing a politician could do. Like, here's something no one would ever do. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? And then just on a daily basis, and then at some point in the like the true Trump, you know, the 4 years of Trump, like an hourly basis, just stuff just started coming true. And now I joke with some of the writers in the cast, like every year, there are certain things that just happen again. Like every year, the daylight savings stuff happens. And that was a big Jonah issue. And it's just, it's like we celebrate Veep stories. You know what I mean? Jonah's crazy immigration stuff. I mean, just, it doesn't stop. So I didn't set out to be a futurist. I swear to God. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I mean, by the way, that daylight savings time, I would like to point out that the Senate, they voted, it's actually to stay on standard time, I think, and stop savings time. Well, you know about this because you've written about it.
Allow me to be a historian for a second. That idea of Jonah going after daylight savings, and obviously he had his own issues because he didn't know what time it was, which was, you know, very Jonah. But for us, right, that was very much trying to find like the 55 mile per hour speed limit law. You know what I mean? Like to find those little tiny things that don't make a difference. One could argue it's the modern day junk fees. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's trying to find those things that move the dial for the voters, but in the grand scheme of things, perhaps maybe aren't actually as important. Not, by the way, I don't like junk fees, but I worry much more about voting rights. You know, I'm not worried that when Trump's going to be a dictator for just a day, there's going to be more junk fees. That's not high on my list of worries. But again, it was just trying to find those sort of things, you know, Reagan did it, Clinton did it, and we sort of just picked a really stupid one. Only it turned out then, you know, the Congress and the Senate were very interested in it. So I don't know, no good answer.
Yeah, and also me. But I'm very interested in it too, as it gets, it's about to be dark here in about 20 minutes. But no, it's true. And it is a low state. I mean, you know, right now in this do nothing Congress, as it's called.
I think that's an insult to previous do nothing Congresses. I would make that argument. Yeah. At least some of those Congresses were trying, maybe. I don't know.
But this Congress can't even name post offices. You know, the complaint about McCarthy was that all McCarthy was doing was naming post offices. Now we have Speaker Johnson, and they're not even naming the post offices anymore.
Well, I think he's allowed to name them, but then he has to let his son know he named them. I'm not sure how that works exactly. Yeah, I'm not sure which son, his regular son or his secret African-American son. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's right. His secret adopted son.
Yeah. I mean, come on, man. I wouldn't write that on Veep, you know, like secret adoption site. Although I guess now I will. But yeah, someday. Yeah. My new show on Max, Secret Adopted Son, coming soon. Yeah.
You actually are doing a show on Santos. Discuss.
I'm not. It is happening. It's Frank Rich is doing it.
But you will end up working on that.
I'm sure I will help, but goddamn, I need a break. And I want better, smarter criminals. You know what I mean? Like, I can't take the gangs that wouldn't shoot straight. The Santos stuff, I don't know, when you start getting into the Botox and whatnot, you just kind of go, come on, really? I mean, his list looked like, someone made this point, it looks like a teenage girl's Christmas list. You know what I mean? Like, where he spent the money.
OnlyFans, yeah. Yeah. Hermes. Looks like my Christmas. No, I'm just kidding. The thing with Santos that I was struck by was he got elected not because he was like a brilliant criminal, right? Like, I mean, with the White House plumbers, you had, you know, the wife was working for the CIA the whole time, right? You had some sort of wasn't she working for the...
Dorothy was a former agent and was a damn good agent.
Who was still sort of in it, right? You know, you had people who were really... This was just like a failure at every... You know, nobody investigated him, so he got elected.
Well, that to me is actually the most interesting point. To me, the most interesting point is just the sort of, if you will, the New York Times just ignoring it. And wasn't it there was like a small local paper like in Long Island that was sort of shouting to the heavens and no one was paying attention. And by the way, at some point, voters get what they deserve. I know we work hard to sort of like make that not happen. But at some point, you just do sometimes kind of go, is this what you want? And I don't even have an answer. But that's the part of the Santos story I find the most fascinating. And then, of course, the Republicans who basically, you know, what are they down to now? One vote when McCarthy leaves, they're basically... They're one death away from possibly...
Because Sheila Jackson Lee went back, yeah.
Yes, that's true. Yes, you're right. So, but I'm just simply saying it's like the idea that the Republicans had to do nothing but sort of protect this guy. You know what I mean? And right. Watching him sort of trying to make friends in the Congress. I don't know. That's right. The part of the story.
He became friends with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Exactly. Yeah. I want to... That's the part of it I really want to dig into. Less the drag queen in Brazil and just more him trying to make friends and like standing next to people who did not want to be standing next to him, but kind of had to. That I find fascinating. Luckily, there's no shortage of hypocrites among the Republican Congress as well. The do nothing or whatever. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, they were happy that the MAGA crew was happy to take him in.
Oh, thrilled. In the grand scheme of things, he's, you know, super qualified, I guess, you know, had a lot of credit card numbers. I don't know, you know.
Right, exactly. He knows how to rip off a lot of people. My favorite part of that whole story actually was, so as they were talking about kicking him out, we had a congressman who had been in the Trump administration, Max Miller, who said that Santos had stolen Max Miller and Max Miller's mother's credit card to take illegal donations from them both. But it turned out that Max Miller was actually had been sort of in trouble for domestic abuse.
Of course. Yeah.
So even the person who is coming out against Santos is not without.
Look, I don't have any answers. I'm not an expert, but somehow this is all Hunter Biden's fault. That's the vibe I'm getting from the Republicans.
It was on the laptop.
Yep. This is what the Bidens have been doing. This is very clear. Yeah, becoming very clear to me. Yeah.
It's the only answer. But I interviewed an expert in presidential impeachments, and we were talking about this sort of legal whatever. And this will be the first presidential impeachment on vibes.
I get an icky feeling. Is that what you mean?
It's just Republicans don't know what, but they know they don't like that guy.
Yeah, as long as it's secretive and behind closed doors, I'm fine with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly.
What did they do? They tried to vote today or yesterday for the Democrats wanted to put in something like open and something into the, I don't even know, the bill about the coming impeachment. And it was voted down by the Republicans. Yeah.
They wanted Hunter Biden to testify. And he said he would testify in an open hearing. And they said, no, they only want him behind closed doors.
How dare you want to testify in an open hearing, which none of the people that were called to testify for anything against Trump ever showed up for. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the double standard is really infuriating. I mean, remember all of those hearings where it was like Jim Jordan won't show. I mean, Jim Jordan defied a congressional subpoena. This is the guy who all he does is send out congressional subpoenas.
And they don't care. I mean, you know, we're talking a little bit about, you know, history, if you will. And it is just this sense of my God, do you even see yourself? I don't know what to say. What was it? John Allen called it there used to be shame. You know what I mean? It's just what happened to shame? Do you hear yourself? Do you see yourself?
So my question, is it a Gore Vidal thing? Is it the United States of amnesia? Are we just too stupid to remember the last season?
I do think that is a flaw in America in general, that we just sort of, I don't know if it's that we're too stupid, but we just like to put it to bed. It's like, that happened, let's move on. That can never happen again. Or that didn't happen, let's just keep going. But I do think there's a little bit more of, what is it, the difference between first and second degree murder? There's a lot more premeditation these days. You know what I mean? I just feel like it's a lot more purposeful, unfortunately, than just stupid. It may be counting on people's stupidity to not remember it, but the people that are trying to do the forgetting, if you will, are far more purposeful and unfortunately just far more sinister. I mean, I don't know, coup jokes don't seem funny anymore. I don't know. Just speaking from a joke standpoint, from a joke writing standpoint, the notion of ha, 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 and here come armed soldiers to take over. It just starts to oh, wait, maybe. I don't know. You know?
Right. I mean, when it's in the possible realm of possibility, I feel like that does undermine.
Yeah. No, it's when it couldn't happen that it seems funny. When it could happen on, whatever, January 7th, I guess. Maybe they'll give us a day next time. I don't know. Or January 20th, 21st, whenever. I don't know. But just it's a lot less funny. I was laughing. I don't know why this keeps making me laugh. I just like the idea that Trump will slowly reduce the amount of time that he's willing to be a dictator, where he'll just kind of give these different statements and go, I will just be a dictator for 6 hours. That's so much better than a day. It's just like, oh, my God, I'll just be Fuhrer for 6 hours. Come on.
Right. Exactly. But it is this larger question of how we got here, where I didn't like W. I mean, I don't know that he was a genius, but he was he made it through Yale. I guess Trump made it through Penn. So forget it. Never mind. A bad example.
I mean, I'll say this, and it's I can think of a lot of Republican presidents that I didn't care for, but I didn't hate them with a passion of 1,000 suns. And I did not feel they were trying to, I don't know, that there was a chance. There was a chance that they would never leave office. You know what I mean? Or try and pass it on. Well, I guess, George Bush technically did eventually pass the presidency on to his son, but there were elections, or at least there were seemingly elections, right. So maybe that's not a good example either, but you know what I'm kind of going for. There's just a true on sense of we just seem like the kind of country we used to make fun of. It just seems like we're a country, some weird little country in Europe that no one oh my God, you see what they did, and it's just now it's us. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah, we're like Liechtenstein, except without all the money.
Some weird little movie of some sort where it's just well, now you're the king. Wait, what? You know?
I think that's a good point. And I do. I also think that we were always a country that the rest of the world made fun of. So the fact that we've only become worse is probably not a great sign.
Not good at all. But I mean, you know, look, there are all these things that we like to ignore, that there are no newspapers. And even there are the newspapers that exist, a lot of people don't read them, and where people are getting their news. And all these things work hand in hand. And maybe it was all part of a master plot. Maybe it wasn't. It doesn't really matter. These things all work together. So it's just kind of like...
to get us here.
Yeah. The average Trump supporter, the diehard, you know, like he's the man, whatever. The fact that like Donald Trump, and by the way, there are probably a lot of Democrats that don't really care about the average working man, but Trump says it out loud and it doesn't seem to change people's opinions. You know what I mean? I just, that's the part where I just go, I don't get it. And I don't know what else to say. Yeah.
I think we should devote like the rest of our time talking about how much tech bros have ruined the world.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Because, well, not political in nature. It is politically adjacent. After making billions of dollars off us, they have decided now they are going to be the mainstream media. Discuss.
Obviously, you know, the great defender of free speech, Elon Musk, has now decided that some speech is freer than others. These tech guys, you know, they've always liked to sort of put themselves into this other category. You know, they were always were, you know, we call them jokingly tech bros, but, you know, they always like wanted to pretend like tech was this other thing. And at the end of the day, they're just robber barons and they just want the same things. They want no taxes. They want their workers to work crazy hours at really terrible price. You know, they just, they want everything that the worst guy from the 1800s wanted, you know? And they, but they, but this idea that somehow that they don't, that it's other because they're doing futuristic stuff. You know, it just, it's just absolute fucking bullshit. Just another group of guys where why not have 20 billion? Oh, if I've got 20 billion, boy, 22 billion would be so much fucking better. Let's just fuck everything up and fuck everyone over. I mean, that's the part that's just disgusting. I don't know what else to say.
My favorite part about Elon, though, is here is this guy, right? We have basically been giving tech bros free content because we were told that it was the only way, right? You have to give them free. You're not allowed to charge. I mean, I remember my mother writing for the Huffington Post a million years ago and people chastising her and being like, you know, you're not making any money. You're devaluing the currency, right? Because she would write for it for free because she'd be on the cover of it. And fast forward, right? Here we are. Now tech bros have gotten our content for free. And now they're like, we don't actually want a mainstream media at all. We're just going to have, you know, the Krasensteins, you know, and Tucker Carlson and, you know, three other guys.
And as of what? As of 2 days ago, Alex Jones now, right? Where Alex is back.
Yeah. But I mean, the mainstream media is such a like piddly little business compared to like.
But this is the problem. I mean, Elon Musk, you know, I guess likes to present himself as one of the smartest men in the world, okay, but bought Twitter basically because he kind of said the wrong thing in some ways, like almost like drunkenly bought a $1 billion company, has run it into the ground, changed the name of it, destroyed the branding of it, opened it up to just insane racism and anti-Semitism. I mean, it's just a day does not go by, and this hasn't happened in years, where just I'm just constantly being attempted to be followed by, you know, bots and fake people in a way that, you know, hadn't gone on in like, you know, 6 years, 7 years, like just crazy mess. But just like, I guess where I'm kind of going with this is ran this thing into the ground where it makes no money. He legitimately lost money on it.
Like about $20 billion, not like.
Right. But it doesn't matter. Because his car company and his space company that we are still giving giant tax breaks to made so much money, it not only paid for his fuck ups, but he can like do even more fuck ups. So that is the oil companies, just it's now a tech guy. And that's the problem.
No, that's right. And I think it's both annoying and also, but I mean, I guess the idea is he doesn't want anyone writing anything bad about him.
Right. I guess everything is free until you criticize him. And honestly, if I had the energy, the only postings I would do would be just, you know, making fun of him. If I had the time and the energy, like that to me is what everyone on Twitter should just be doing. Like literally posting nothing but making up stuff about him. And honestly, at some point, I think it's better to do stuff that's real. But honestly, I would, if I could command the world, just post fake shit about Elon Musk day and night. Just inundate the site. That would be enjoyable. But again, no lesson learned, because even if he shut it down tomorrow, but even if he just said, Twitter's done, I'm gone, we're closing the doors, it doesn't work anymore, he wouldn't lose any money, and he'd probably figure out a way to sell all our home addresses or something, or all our right, email addresses right, to someplace even worse. You know what I mean? So I don't know. That's the problem. When you can do this and somehow continue to profit, that is our system in a nutshell. Yeah. Oh, God, I've depressed
Thank
myself.
You.
I got to call my therapist. Sorry. This. Yeah.
Dave Mandel, please come back.
Anytime. I always love it. I always love coming on saying hi.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on Season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt Tiernauer is a director of films like Where Is My Roy Cohen and Valentino, The Last Emperor.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Matt.
Thank you.
First, you've made so many amazing movies, but I want to talk to you about Roy Cohen because I feel like this all starts with Roy Cohen. Trumpism, this whole shit show, Roy Cohen.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, he's really the Zelig of our present moment. A few years ago, I put out a movie called Where's My Roy Cohn, the title given to me by the former guy who exclaimed when Jeff Sessions wouldn't do his bidding as Attorney General, where's my Roy Cohn? Meaning, where's my law-breaking, convention-busting, mob-adjacent attorney/Attorney General? And the premise of that film was to show people in what Gore Vidal used to call the United States of amnesia.
We're just talking about this. Yes. In the last interview, I said, does this relate to the United States of amnesia?
Exactly. The man who was Svengali to Joe McCarthy was Svengali to Donald Trump. So that type of politic was always brewing, kind of coming up above the surface, occasionally geysering, like in the McCarthy period. Going back down, then the John Birch era, going back down, and then really it's back with a vengeance, of course. I mean, it's gone back down during during the Biden 3 years, but now we're poised for another big explosion.
I think about Gore Vidal, who I knew a little bit when I was a kid, and how he was of that generation of writers, not so different in age, a little bit older than Christopher Hitchens, but those guys really wrote these political pieces that really had a lot of breadth to them. I wonder why we don't have that so much anymore.
Well, I don't think people read essays in the popular press anymore. It's weird because just like the magazine, I used to be a magazine journalist at Vanity Fair, and the magazine's really dead. That type of magazine used to be it. You know, that was the great prestige thing. And that as a forum really doesn't exist in that way anymore because media has become atomized. Of course, people write at length in places like Medium and Substack, and there's wonderful thinking and writing, but it's not in that sort of front and center place anymore where Hitchens or a Vidal or a heaven forfend William F. Buckley could be public figures and public intellectuals. And for God's sakes, I mean, those guys were on the Dick Cavett Show and Johnny Carson and Merv Griffin.
We had public debates.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was just more focused. I mean, if you're old enough to remember the twilight of the great Anchorman era, when you had a Walter Cronkite and a John Chancellor, and later a Brokaw and a Jennings and a Rather to sort of give you an agreed upon agenda that conformed to an idea of the public trust in media, which was that there were agreed upon facts. I mean, of course, sometimes the narratives were wrong, but they were generally, I think, more in the public trust.
More right than they are now.
Certainly. And people looked to those figures. So there was sort of like a focal point. Now, of course, everything's atomized and we don't need to get into that because it's the Twitterverse or the experts. And I think that's just a symptom of the present moment in media that we're in. But it, like everything, it's everyone's distracted and strung out and their cortisol levels are so high because we're all kind of like bobbing our heads up and down to our iPhones and red-pilled and blue-pilled. I think of Vidal and a Hitchens and the great public intellectuals of the time, you know, a Sontag even, they wouldn't command the same type of audience. Of course, they'd be Twitter stars. And where does that get you? I mean, You're a Twitter star, aren't you? I mean, what do you think your influence is compared to a Hitchens?
What kind of question? Wait, no. You don't get to. You're on my podcast, buddy. You don't get to ask me. First of all, I'm not going to answer that question because what is my influence compared to a Hitchens? Or more influential than Hitchens?
Well, it's rhetorical.
But I mean, I think, I don't know, that world doesn't exist anymore. As someone who is very much a product of that world, I don't think that tech bro barons are such a great thing because, you know, they have a completely narcissistic interest in the mainstream media and interest in creating their own media, like a sort of in-style magazine for 2023, right? They just want sort of adulation. But I also think that back then, you know, you had this incredible bar to entry, right? You couldn't have, you know, there were the people who were part of the media were affluent. They were largely white. They were almost always men. They were, you know, they had a very similar worldview. The narratives were very, very similar. It was not easy to break in. And it was also, there was not a lot of diversity of thought. So I think, like, yes, there was some great writing that happened during that period. And I think about Tom Wolfe's journalism was like some of the best, right? All these people are white men. There are a few women who are allowed to, you know, there's a Joan Didion once in a while, but like, you know, they're pretty white and they're pretty male. So in my mind, I don't necessarily think that we were so well off then, but I do think what we have now is also very problematic.
Yeah. I mean, you just outlined the bad part. That was really the bad part. Of course. Of course. I mean, there's a good part to all of the atomization, of course, but obviously there's their great danger looms ahead. The media barons before had to adhere to a kind of guardrail, which was the public trust. If you were going to be licensed, you had to be responsible. Puts a period to that sentence that you were talking about.
Right.
Yeah, of course, more diversity is better, but managing media companies and the so-called public square, the sense of the public trust that the great FCC chairman Newton Minow declared in the 60s, you know, has just whittled away.
So what are you working on now?
Politics-wise, I'm actually, and I think this is the first time this has ever been revealed, I'm doing a documentary about your guest of, I think, 3 days ago, James Carville.
Yes, he told me. That's right. He actually did tell me. A Carville documentary. How did you get there? And also, I am delighted.
You know, James has been on the scene for more than 30 years now. It's hard to maintain that level of household name fame for that long and relevance. And I think he's an American original. I thought that would be a great person to focus on. I think he's also a truth teller. And I think he's the one Democrat that can speak to people who are limousine liberals, it seems, which is an incredibly important trait right now in our present political moment. So it's also a meditation on politics of the last 30 years, at first through his lens as someone who's credited with helping Clinton win the White House, teaching Democrats that they could win again, how to win an election, which often is, I think, something that Democrats don't really pay heed to. I think people forget that James Carville and Mary Matalin were political media supernovae in the 90s. And I want to go back and look at that moment because they were a bipartisan marriage, absolute superstars, household names, and they really captured the American imagination. I think people were sort of filtering their own marriages through them. And that moment, I think, is really fascinating to reexamine. So it's all wrapped up in this movie I'm doing on James. I've been following him for approximately 2 years as he stumped the country. Still very active.
Yes.
And very relevant. I mean, he was the first in Kansas, the National Democrat. You know, I think he'd be the only National Democrat to go to Kansas when they were doing the pro-choice referendum. And that won, which was a bellwether.
He actually really is very much part of America. I mean, he spends a lot of time, right, in parts of Louisiana that don't have a Starbucks.
Far from it. I mean, he's from a place called Carville, Louisiana, where I filmed with him. I think it was 98% Black when he grew up, and I think it still is almost that ratio. They were the family that kind of had the postal concession there and ran the general store. What I realized when I went back there with James is that I think his empathy and his life's project is to help the marginalized through Democratic politics because he comes from one of the most marginalized communities in the United States. Yes, he was a white guy in a really poor Black part of Louisiana, but he emerged as a pro-civil rights political activist who I think learned empathy by seeing all of the disadvantaged people with whom he grew up. And he devoted his life to try to correct the wrongs that were embedded in the economic political system of this country. So that's really the Carville project I've discovered. And that type of progressive politics of that era is something he embodies. And he's the best kind of soundbite strategist and big picture strategist, I think, that politics has had in probably several generations.
I also, it's interesting, like, I think about, like, the Republican equivalent of him. Is that, like, Newt Gingrich?
Well, I think at a moment it was probably Lee Atwater.
Right. Oh, that's a good point.
And Lee Atwater died young. And interestingly, Atwater was the mentor of Mary Matalin, who's James Carville's wife. So there are a lot of strange and coincidental, or maybe not so coincidental, themes in this that emerge from the politics of that era that prefigures our own. much like my Morricone movie, I that's what I like doing. I like kind of digging out hidden themes or themes that have gone underground in the United States of amnesia, since we're not taught history and no one remembers anything, or we can Google it and then forget it 2 seconds later. I think that's how I like to address my form, or kind of practice my form, which is the long deep dive cinematically to be a sort of national reckoning moment of these themes that have haunted us throughout the 20th century. And we seem to forget them. And then they come up and hit us in the face like a 2x4 because we're not looking.
Were you able to interview any of the Clintons?
I interviewed A. Clinton, who was in a presidential situation one time. Yeah.
That's the one. Probably the most relevant one to that movie, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, they're both, well, actually, Hillary hired James, I think, more or less. I mean, it really was the 2-for-1 era of the Clintons at that time. I mean, she was very important in the campaign, and she was a chief strategist in that campaign. It's really interesting to kind of go granular and revisit how that campaign worked, because you have to remember, in the early 90s, a lot of really wise people around Democratic politics thought there'd never be another Democratic president again.
After Carter.
Yeah, I mean, after Jimmy Carter's loss and Walter Mondale's loss and Reagan, you know, Poppy Bush's triumph and as the third term of Ronald Reagan. I think what Bill Clinton and James Carville and the people involved with that campaign showed was that you could win as a Democrat. And I don't agree with a lot of their politics, frankly. I'm a little more liberal than those people. But I think that's one of the lessons of Carville that's relevant to this moment, is you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You've got to win election in order to affect change. And I mean, when he talks to you on this podcast, he preaches that. And I think it's a really important lesson for us, especially at this time when we have such fractious politics and identitarian politics that is a particular problem in the Democratic Party. I think James has been the one who's spoken up and just said, look, everyone, like, let's just get a Democrat elected and not face the abyss and the dissolution of the project that the founders kicked off 250 years.
Yeah, you definitely have much higher stakes than a sort of normal politics. But that movie, The War Room, yeah, was one of the great movies about a political campaign.
It was. It's a D.A. Pennebaker film. He's one of my heroes, really one of the gods of cinema verite filmmaking, which is the type of filmmaking I like to do most. He embedded in the 92 Little Rock headquarters. And in that film, if the audience hasn't seen it, you get to see Carville and George Stephanopoulos, who was the communications director at that time before his media career for Bill Clinton, fear the campaign. And it's a really interesting fly on the wall look at how brilliant they were, and particularly James. It's really James's movie to see his vision and what a kind of inspiring visionary character he was. And also, by the way, up from nothing, he was a total failure, James Carville, until he was in his, I think, late 40s. He hit it when he was about 50 with that campaign.
Aren't we all, man? I do think that George Stephanopoulos does not age. Or he was 11 in that movie.
Maybe both.
Maybe both. Matt, very excited to see that movie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.